Thank you, members. I'm going to call the tax committee to order. And members, I think that's we still need to lay over Representative Simpson's bill for possible inclusion, but I don't believe we have a quorum to do that yet. So we'll hold on that. That was the governor's tax proposal of last time, which we didn't take any action. So we'll need to make that motion. Members, what we're going to do today is we're going to hear House File 496, which is the department's bill. I'm the chief author as a courtesy to the department and the governor, and Representative Simpson is the second author on that bill. So I'm going to move to the front table here and ask Revenue to join me, and we'll work on House File 496. Mr. Chair.
Representative Lynchinsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 496, and I believe we have an author's amendment as well. I don't know if Mr. Manson has it for me here.
That would be the A070023.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the A070023 amendment.
At this time, if there is no objections, Chair will take a motion to move the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, as I stated, this is the department's bill that you and I, Mr. Chair, are, as a courtesy to the department and the governor, we're chief authoring. And at this time, I'd like to ask Mr. Manson to just begin walking through the bill, which I believe everyone has the summary and the revenue note in their packets. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Mr. Manson.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm Jack Manson with the Department of Revenue. I'm going to give kind of some introductory comments, and then I think if that's okay with the author, we'll actually have the presenters from the department attorneys come up and present each of their articles.
Okay, thank you.
This is House File 496. This is the department tax bill, and I just want to make it clear that this does contain both technical and minor policy provisions. It's not just solely a technical bill. And what this bill does is it really seeks to improve the tax system in about basically three different ways. One is just kind of cleans up the current statutes, so it eliminates obsolete language, but also it corrects errors and omissions and incorrect cross-references and things like that. It also clarifies current language, and this makes the wording changes to help make the law a little more understandable, but it also clarifies what the department's position is on certain policy items in the law. And the third thing it does is it recommends policy positions on either new items that are coming up as the economy changes or things that we've just newly discovered, maybe as we've reviewed the statutes or issues we've come across on audits. So we make recommendations on what those policy positions should be, and then it's ultimately your call on, you know, what the final policy will be on those issues. In your packet,
Mr. Manson, I think at this time we have a quorum, so why don't we vote on the amendment? We can do that, correct?
Mr. Chair, I'd renew the author's amendment,
8070023. Okay. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Manson. Go ahead.
And Mr. Chair, and then in your packet should be a revenue analysis dated February 5th, 2007. And you can see from that it's actually negligible is kind of the sum of the parts. And this is as proposed to be amended. So the bill does contain provisions that have money implications, but the amendment has taken those items out. So, and then behind that, I believe, is the summary. The bill summary, I think, is attached to that. Might be on the second side of that page. And you can use that to follow through along with the presenters if you'd like. And then one last comment I'd like to make is that we did send out around Christmas time a brief listing of everything that would possibly be in our bills just to a lot of the different organizations that are interested in our bill. I think it was over about 150 different emails and representatives, so it got kind of widely distributed. We did receive some comments just asking questions a little more about it or other things that were a little controversial and do need a little more work. And those items were deleted in this amendment as well. So unless there's any questions, we could have the presenters come up and start going through the bill.
All right, Representative Lincheski, is that your desire?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have the list in order as Mr. Manson does, but I think the first person we have is Mr. Haugen is going to join us on the income and corporate tax. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm John Haugen from the Department of Revenue. I'll be going over the income tax Article 1. And as we go through, I'll be using the section by section summary. It's pretty much.
I don't need my.
I have one.
Oh. The first section, the section 1, 13, 14, and 16 deal with how we do. There are various thresholds that we use for individual income tax, where we increase the thresholds for inflation. A lot of these thresholds, they're all written a little bit differently in the statute. Some of them have a base year that goes from August. Most of them go from the end of August to the end of August in the next year. Some of them start at September 1st and go to September 1st of the next year. Some of them have different things. But anyway, what the idea was behind the changes in sections 1, 13, 14, and 16 was more or less to make the language for all of these indexing provisions very, very similar, have the same August 31st base year. The other thing that some of the indexing provisions didn't have was it didn't have any language that said, okay, if we're indexing to the nearest, you know, is it to the nearest $1,000, is it to the nearest $5, or do we actually have to, when we index, when we have these things and it comes out to, you know, $10,001, do we have to say, okay, we have to put that in the instructions? So what we've always done is we index to the nearest $10, we round to the nearest $10. If it's $5, then we round up. So we're making that consistent for all of these indexing provisions. The indexing provisions that we're talking about, the dependent care credit, the working family credit, the alternative minimum tax exemption that we raised last year, all of those are now indexed for inflation. And we're making them all fairly similar so that we're doing it the same way and there's not as many questions by research as to whether we're doing the indexing correctly. Section 2 deals with what's on the individual income tax return. Currently, if you fill out your M1, one of the lines says we ask you for your date of birth. Current law says that that's not, well, it doesn't say that it's required. What this provision would do, it would say that to make this a valid return, you have to put your date of birth, so it would be a required item that you have to put on your return. So it will be the first time, if this is passed, that I have to put my birth date on my return. The next section deals with withholding tax. Currently, we have...
Mr. Haugen, excuse me, we have a question here. Do we want to go through the whole thing, or should we just... Representative Lincheski, should we just take questions as we go here?
Mr. Chair, I'd prefer to take questions as we go due to the fact that we're going to have five different people speak to us from revenue, and
right.
I think as we go is the best way.
Sounds fine.
Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you just explain why these are needed? Why do you have to make this required?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, are you talking about the date of birth in particular? The date of birth, what we use that for is for verification purposes. One, we have a number of people where on their return they'll transpose a number in their Social Security number. So we try to more or less then, when we get that return, match it up with the right person. And sometime when you have a common name, like Anderson, Carlson, whatever, it's really hard to match those up. Date of birth, if we have that in our field, we can match that up with the correct field that we had from the other place. The other situation that we have is people will call in and they'll ask, well, what did I do on my income tax return for the year before? Now, all of the tax information is private data, so we always ask questions about personal questions so that we can determine, yeah, this is the person that's calling in. And one of the things that we'd like to ask is the date of birth, and if we have that on the return, we can ask that question.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do the feds require birth dates already on their forms?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it's my knowledge they don't.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Lanchesky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Liebling and members. I should point out, I don't want to embarrass Mr. Michael here, but Mr. Michael just told me he did this exact same thing in working on his wife's taxes, and that was transposing a number in her Social Security. So even Mr. Michael has made errors in past members. But this provision, in discussing it earlier, it can be perceived as controversial by some. So I would encourage Representative Liebling or any other member to know that any provision that's in this bill, if you would like it out, just say so and we'll take it out, because the intent of this bill is that the department bring forward provisions that are non-controversial and non-money items. So if there's a concern, you should say that and we will remove them, and the bill will be then considered for the larger omnibus tax bill. But so anything controversial from anyone's perspective is legit to pull out.
Thank you. Representative Carlson.
Chairman, maybe of the department, on the state of birth question, I happen to be a retired teacher, and we had a lot of immigrant students at the school that I taught in. And instead of a specific date of birth, they designated their date of birth by season.
By what?
By season. And so how would you handle that? And you'd reference common names like Carlson, Anderson, and so on. Some of those names were even more common, and I'm told that what they would do, everybody selected January 1st when they were required to do that because they didn't really have a date. So you're going to have a large number of people in some communities that will have January 1st of whatever year and the same last name.
Mr. Hagan, would you like to?
Accomplishing, I guess, the question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, you're correct with, I assume you're talking about the Hmong community, and I'm not sure about the Somali community. They have a lot of similar last names, and they do that. You know, it would be nice if we're doing it for everybody else as well, so we're getting that benefit. For those people, it is difficult, you know, and in certain ways, this won't help with that problem where you have those people where they've transposed a number or they're calling in for their tax information. We do ask them, you know, what their Social Security number is, and they do have those, so, you know, that's one way of verifying, but sometimes we take a second step if we aren't really sure that that's the person calling. But with those people, it is difficult. And
Mr. Chairman, and you did, the high school I taught in, we had large numbers for both communities who were enrolled at that particular school site. Thank you.
Okay. Representative DeLaForce.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Just a brief follow-up question on this subject. Question for the department. You're requiring every person who files a return to list their date of birth. What's the universe of the problem? How pervasive is this transposing a number problem? Mr. Michael, aside. is this a big issue?
Mr. Chairman, Representative DeLaForest, no, I don't, you know, it's a very small percentage, but the percentage that we do have, it does take our time to actually solve, you know, to more or less come up with, yeah, this is the right person, this payment goes into this account, not this Social Security number, and it does save us time.
Thank you. Any other question, members? Otherwise, go ahead, Mr. Hagan.
Section 3 deals with withholding tax returns, or W-2s filed by employers with the state of Minnesota. Current law says that if you're an employer and you have more than 250 employees nationwide and you're doing business in Minnesota, you have to give us the W-2s. Our law says that it's by electronic media. Federally, they're now saying that you have to do it by electronic means. In other words, you more or less give a computer, do it over the internet, you send us it electronically. What the department proposal here is that we would go and we were going to more or less, one of the legislative auditors' recommendations when they looked at the Department of Revenue was that we have a lot of W-2s that come in on paper, that there are so many of them that we really can't do much with them. There's over a million of them that come in on paper. So their recommendation was is to get more and more people to file their W-2s so that we can use them efficiently electronically. So right now we have, if I remember correctly the numbers, we have about 150,000 employers. Of those, about a third or 50,000 file, give us it in an electronic format. Those 150,000 employers, they issue about 5 million W-2s. Of those, about 75% are filed electronically. So we're getting right now the bulk of them electronically, but we'd like to increase the 75% number. So what the department proposal is starting in 2007, for the 2007 withholding tax returns, if you had more than 100 Minnesota employees, you would have to file with Minnesota electronically. Then that number would drop down to 25 for 2008, and then 10 if you had 10 or more for 2009 and thereafter, you'd have to give us that information electronically. What that would do, it would mean that for the number of employers, we would go from one-third of them filing electronically to about half. There would still be about 73,000 employers who would still have less than 10 employees Minnesota-wide, but they could still file on paper. But what it does is that we would be getting about 95% of the W-2s electronically. So the department proposal is to require more people to electronically file. Sections 4 and 5 deal with mutual funds.
Mr. Hagan, we have a question. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'm asking a lot of the questions today. I remember this is one of the things we talked about in terms of compliance issues to help the department, do a better job there. But I just want to know a little more about the burden on the employers. How easy or hard is it to file electronically as compared to the paper? Is this actually doing them a favor? Or not?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, I think I will have somebody from the Withholding Tax Division come up and more or less explain how much work it is to electronically file as opposed to, what they're currently doing now on paper. This is Vicki Dickinson, who's the supervisor in the Withholding Tax area.
Okay. Welcome, Ms. Dickinson.
Thank you. We just put together a system this year that allows employers to submit their information over the Internet. It came up on December 20th. To date, we've gotten about 28,000 employers that have voluntarily done it with this new system. We've gotten a little over 300,000 of the W-2s. Taxpayers can either key in the information right on the screen. There's about 5 pieces of data. Or they can put all that information into a text file and submit that file. Or they can just submit the file that is created in the format that the federal government requires. So it's very easy. All the feedback that we've gotten from employers to date has been positive.
Representative
Lee? Mr. Chair, Ms. Dickinson, do the other agencies besides W-2, do you get all those forms electronically? Mutual fund payments, dividends, qualifying dividends from, I'm sure many people get the other types of forms. Are they all submitted to you electronically?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, we don't get those electronically at the time that we could use them in order to process the individual returns. We do get them later from the federal government.
Representative Silverberg?
I get, several of those little things from the banks and interest payments. So if I do my W-2s electronically, how do I handle all the other little mutual fund I've got that says so much is, dividend and so much is capital gains, so forth, qualifying?
That information comes from the federal government about a year and a half after you file your return, so then we can do that verification after the fact instead of during the processing.
So I get my return fast if I've been careful, is that what you said? So it is electronic. You do get it electronically. Is that what you're saying?
We do get it about a year and a half later. The problem is that the information that we get from the federal government doesn't include the state withholding. So we don't have a way to verify that the withholding amount that you're taking is accurate unless we get the W-2 information ourselves. The 1099 and other information generally, there is no state withholding. So it's the state withholding we're trying to verify.
Okay, President Solberg.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Go ahead, Representative Chesky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe a point of clarification on this item, members. This provision is in the governor's tax proposal. It's part of the tax compliance initiative that he's put forward. It is additionally part of the Office of the Legislative Auditor that we heard testify as a recommendation when we heard that report. And that was the W-2 provision that people might remember. And so we've heard it a couple of times. And I think what it gets at is getting data to the Department of Revenue so that it can be more efficient and more effective in its tax compliance and collections. Thank you.
Okay. To that point, Representative Lightling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up, just if you could just tell us real briefly what plans you have to advise people of the change.
Right now, the employers all file their returns electronically. So at the time they go in to file the return, we're asking them, do you want to submit the W-2s at the same time you file the return? If it were to be required of everybody that has more than 100, we tell them at that time, you're required to do it electronically because you have more than 100. When it goes to 25, we do the same thing. When it goes to 10, we do it again then.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Hagan.
Sections 4 and 5 get to Representative Solberg's question. Right now, for the 1099s that people send are that they give out federally, Minnesota, those aren't sent to the Department of Revenue unless we specifically ask the mutual fund or the bank or whatever to send us to those, to send us the 1099. So we don't get those on an ongoing basis. If we have an audit project where we're looking at something, we might request the payor to give us the 1099s. Then they have 60 days to send in the 1099s. What Sections 4 and 5 are dealing with are mutual funds that pay federal tax-exempt dividends that they're from out-of-state municipal bonds. Those, for Minnesota purposes, we tax those. So we would like to have that information. Under the current law, we can get that information, but we have to specifically ask for it like the other 1099s. This would make an exception for these mutual funds that are paying these federal taxes and to dividends, that they would have to automatically send them into the Department of Revenue by March 15th. So that's the change there, going from a 60-day demand period to more or less requiring them to be sent in on an ongoing basis. Section 6 deals with partnership returns and S-corporation returns. In the past, we've had, and I should say that it's mostly with large partnerships, where they have a great number of partners. Each year, when they do their partnership return, they send us a partnership return. It has what's called a K-1, that's an information return for the partners. For a lot of these big ones, they make a transposition error on the K-1 for the partner's federal ID number, the Social Security number. We try, then what happens is those people, when we do a match to see whether that Social Security number reported that partnership income, well, naturally, since it's the wrong person, they didn't report that partnership income. And also, their name doesn't really match with what they've got on the K-1. So what we do is we notify the partnerships that you got a bad Social Security number. We give them the correct one, and then we think, well, logically they would correct that for the next year. But invariably what happens, they're a big organization, and the next year we get the same number with the same transposition error. So what this provision would say is that once we've told the partnership or the S corporation that they've got a bad Social Security number, if the next year and the succeeding years they give us the same bad number, we can assess them a $50 penalty for each time they make a mistake like that. Section 7 deals with the property tax refund. Current law says that if you file a property tax refund and it's the amount you're claiming is overstated, there's a penalty of 10% of what your corrected property tax refund is. This would change it so that the penalty is 10% of the property tax refund that you overclaimed. So, for instance, if you were claiming a $1,000 property tax refund and it really only should have been $400, there is $600 discrepancy, so the penalty under our proposal would be 10% of the $600 or $60. On the other hand, the way it works now is that there would be a 10% penalty on the $400 that was allowed and would only be a 40% penalty. So it can cut both ways. The real problem is that if you have a property tax refund where they more or less are claiming, let's say, $1,000 and they should have gotten zero, well, under our current law, the penalty, 100% or 10% of zero is zero, so there's no penalty. This would more or less penalize them from the erroneous the fact that they're claiming more than they should. Section 8.
Mr. Hagan, Representative Earhart.
Tell me, Mr. Chairman, we're talking about the circuit breaker here.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Earhart, that's correct.
Okay, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Earhart.
Is there any reason, and I don't think we've changed this, that we can't get this back in the same timely manner that we get our income tax refunds back instead of waiting until, September 30th or something or other?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Earhart, as I understand you, you want to put this back as part of the income tax so that they get their property tax refund at the same time as their income tax refund?
Why not?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that I'm prepared to answer that question other than it would be, I think it would shift money from one fiscal year to an earlier fiscal year that probably might be sufficient so that it might not be fiscally possible to do that would be my guess.
Well,
Mr. Chairman, anything is fiscally possible if you want to make it so. So is there any reason outside of that that we can't make that in a timely manner instead of, otherwise you get people calling you up and wanting to know where their property tax refund is, they should get it back when they file for it. Just like you could say the same thing about your income tax refund. We're not going to pay you the next period because we want to keep things out of balance.
Mr. Hagan.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Earhart, I think no matter when we paid it out, we'd probably get if they expected it in April, if we had to pay it out on April 15th, they'd call on February 15th. I don't know that we're going to really short-circuit the calls. People, as soon as they file the return and they want the money, they will call within a couple of weeks to see where it is, if they're that type of person.
So
I don't know that we really save on any phone calls by having us move it up from September 15th to April 15th.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you don't pay any interest on the fact that it's due, when you file. It seems to me that when you file something, that should be the date that date of record that you decide that, hey, we owe the guy some money and we owe it them. What is going to happen if I, Mr. Chairman, if I put in a amendment to that effect or a bill to that effect? Are you going to fight it tooth and nail and I'm wasting my time? Is that the deal or what?
Mr. Hagan.
Mr. Chairman, I don't really know how to respond to your question other than I don't think, you can propose a provision. The department likes it sort of staggers. But the way we process returns, we can process returns through, let's say, May and get the income tax returns out of the way instead of having, and then that gives us a few months more or less to do the property taxes. It orders our work a little bit better having the staggering. Well, yes, we could probably do it so that we could have the property tax refund paid out at the same time by April 15th.
Thank you.
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chair, in looking at the first page of our summary, we have a negligible, and the staff just told me one's a negligible, less than 5,000 negative, and one's a negligible, 5,000 positive. But as I look through this, in Section 6, Section 7, Section 9, we're looking at some penalties. First of all, are those penalties in place now?
And if they are not in place, do we have a revenue estimate on those?
Mr. Hogan.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, traditionally penalties, the way that we score things, we always assume that people are going to do things so that they don't get the penalties. So the penalties never really generate any additional revenue, even though as a practical matter they do. So the revenue estimate does not take into account any revenue increases from penalties.
Oh, Chairman, I guess I should have been on the tax committee a lot earlier in my career. The revenue has done that all the time?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Right.
Representative Carlson.
I'm looking at that Section 7 on the property tax refund return. How do you define the difference between negligence and a simple error? And, Mr. Chairman, where I'm coming at that from, you know, the way the IRS and our own Department of Revenue operate, you know, it's kind of a prove your innocent kind of approach to our tax laws. So if you could explain, before you assess that penalty, what process you go through to determine negligence versus a simple error.
Mr. Hogan.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, I think the easiest way to give some examples. For instance, if you make a math error on the return, I make them all the time on my return, and the department bills me for additional tax. That probably is not negligence. You know, we would not consider that negligence. If, on the other hand, you understated your household income because you didn't throw in the welfare or you didn't throw in a couple W-2s, something like that, that we would probably consider negligent, and we would assess you the penalty to the extent that you were claiming that. If you had, you know, if you were, for instance, if you had a dispute about whether one of your children was your dependent or your ex-spouse's, that, can you claim that child as your dependent? That probably in most situations wouldn't be negligence.
I'll have to think that through. Just the way the system operates, that maybe clarifies it a little bit, but I'm still having trouble, even with your example of somebody that perhaps forgot to add something back in to their income, which sometimes happens. You know, would that be negligent or is it an error? Through the years, helping them for senior citizens, and I'm surprised at how confused they get. That's probably one of the reasons I was helping them. And get that return would be possibly, by the way, you just described it, considered negligent.
Mr. Hogan.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, it's sort of a facts and circumstances type thing. And, you know, to be honest, we don't assess that many negligence penalties unless what they did was fairly egregious. We understand that people, you know, they make mistakes. They, you know, minor things they might forget about. But if you have a $30,000 capital gain or something like that that you forgot, well, that's, you know, it depends on how significant the amounts that they forgot were, is the bottom line.
Okay. Representative Mark Horn first.
Sir.
Representative Solberg.
Your question for the last one was astounding and shocking, even for some of the staff that are much more serious, knowledgeable than I would ever be. Do you assume then that when you put a penalty in, that everyone's going to follow the law and no penalties will be assessed?
Mr. Hogan.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, that is my understanding. If there's somebody from research.
Because I don't think when we put a penalty in for the criminal justice system that we assume that everyone's going to follow the law and no penalties are going to be assessed.
Mr. Manson, would you like to take a shot at that?
Representative Solberg,
That has been traditionally the way the department has scored penalties. It's to act as a deterrent and change taxpayers' behavior. We've assumed that's what the penalty will do. So we have not ever in history that I've been around anyway have scored that as part of a revenue raiser. It's just kind of something that helps deter folks to change their behavior, and hopefully it works.
We do the same thing with every criminal penalty that I've ever had with. We assume that we're going to all be 100% law-abiding citizens and do that. And but we all make mistakes sometimes, and obviously we get penalties. Mr. Chair, and sir, can I get a report from the department of how much income has come into the department from penalties in the last couple of bienniums? I would think you would have an accounting of that.
Mr. Chairman, I can supply that to the committee.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Markport.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hogan, quick question. This came up today on the property tax comment line, and I hadn't thought about this before, but it's on property tax refunds. And it's the person who applied for the property tax refund based on the previous year but dies before the check is actually issued. What is the Department of Revenue? The understanding from the comment I received is that there would be no check issued. And I'm just wondering, could that go to the estate, or how does that work? Maybe.
That's my bill from last year.
Oh, okay. So they don't get, well.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Markhart, the way, if you take a look at the property tax refund statute, and I can't really remember which part of section of 290A it is, but it specifically says that if you don't live long enough to be entitled to the refund lapses unless you have a surviving spouse or a dependent child. And that's what the statute says. So basically, if you don't live to September 15th or the August 15th, depending on what it was, the refund lapses. And we really shouldn't, you know, if we find out about it, we'll more or less take you give the check. We'll try to get you to give the check back. Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Mallory.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was just going to say that I had a donor last year and again this year too, that the check was then voted to stay.
Okay. Thank you.
Very good.
Mr. Hogan, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Section 8 deals with the recently in the tax shelter disclosure penalties that we put in a couple years ago. The way that they, to get off the hook for this penalty, we have an incorrect reference to more or less that we talk about the reasonable cause exception for getting out of this penalty. Really, it should be referencing the way that you get out of the penalty for substantial understatement, and we're just correcting that reference. Section 9 deals with tax preparers. What this provision would say is that when you're filling out a Minnesota return, and you're a paid tax preparer, you have to put your ID number that you get federally, that you put on federal returns that you prepare on the Minnesota return, so that we can do more or less, we can know who the tax preparer was in a more timely fashion. And if you don't, we can assess the tax preparer a $50 penalty. Section 10 is part of the amendment, and that's taken out of the bill, so I won't really talk about that one. Section 11, there is a part of that, if you look at page 14, lines 12 through 25, and 28 through 32, those are also being taken out of the bill, but there still is, these are subtractions from federal taxable income in more or less coming up with Minnesota taxable income. In Section 11, there is a provision more or less changing the site to a federal public law dealing with basically it's foreign banks and insurance companies that more, we did a change last year that said that where we changed the site to the public law for the addition, we neglected to do it for the subtraction, so if that company had a loss, they'd actually get a subtraction. So we're just cleaning that up in Section 11. The other thing that was going on is in the corporate subtractions, there was a credit called the Federal Jobs Credit. Well, that's now called the Federal Work Opportunity Credit, so we're just changing the name of that. That's the rest of Section 11. Section 12 deals with the bovine testing credit. that was enacted last year where if you're a farmer and you're required or you have to have your cattle tested for tuberculosis, the state will pay a credit of 50% of the cost that you incur. But what this provision does, it puts a sunset on that credit so that the year after the testing is no longer required federally, the Minnesota credit goes away. So as long as it's required federally, we'll be giving the credit, but once the federal test mandate for testing goes away, then the credit goes away as well. Section 15 deals with the military combat zone credit that was enacted last year. The current law more or less says that for this year we're giving out a credit to these military people for all of the months that they were in combat between September 11th of 2001 through the end of 2006. Now for that one, if you were a person that was in this situation, you were a Minnesota resident while you were in the combat zone, and you died before 2006, the way that the current law reads is that you would not get this credit unless you had to have died as a result of something that occurred in the combat zone, and then two, even if you did die as a result of something in the combat zone, the only people that could get it would be a surviving spouse or a dependent child. So if if the service member just had a father or a mother, and you died as a result of injuries in the combat zone, you wouldn't be entitled to the credit. What this proposal would do, it would more or less for the back years, for the 2001 through 2006 stuff, it would say, we really don't care where you died or whether you have a surviving spouse, we're going to give you the credit anyway and we'll pay it to your estate. So that's 15. 16, or 17 we're at? Is another citation type thing dealing with where the law was changed, where we used to reference subdivision 7, that's now in subdivision 6N, so we're just changing that internal reference. Section 18 deals with the property tax refund. Back in the old days, we had a provision that said, where back in the old days, before 2005, you were a dependent only if more than half of your support was provided by somebody else. So what happened for the property tax refund is you would have a number of people, especially where they were on welfare. Welfare was providing more than 50% of the support. Technically, before we changed the law, those kids would not have been dependents. So we put in a provision saying that you didn't count the welfare. That was just sort of thrown out of the computation no matter what. So in other words, those people for the property tax refund, those people would be dependents for the property tax refund even though they wouldn't get dependent for individual income tax. In 2005, they changed the test for who's a dependent from somebody providing more than 50% of the support to saying that as long as the child doesn't provide more than 50% of the support, they'll be a dependent of somebody. So this language that we had in the property tax refund really doesn't apply to anybody any longer, so we're removing it from the property tax refund. The last section deals with the estate tax. We're now on sort of a standalone Minnesota estate tax instead of piggybacking on the federal estate tax. There has been, and we've been doing that for a number of years, but it's come to our attention that theoretically, the department doesn't have the ability to challenge valuations that are put on the estate tax return. For instance, if you had a condo that was probably worth $200,000, but you listed it at $50,000 on the estate tax return, the Department of Revenue, under some readings of the statute, wouldn't have any authority to challenge that valuation and say, wait a second, this is way undervalued and it's really worth $250,000. So this would more or less put in back to what we had in 1985, languages that said that we can come up with the Department of Revenue could come up with independent valuations of probate of assets that are included in the taxable estate.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. why are you not accepting what the Internal Revenue Evaluation is going? Are they off that much, or there must be some conflict here? That
Mr. Chairman, Representative Earhart, if the IRS actually looked at all of the valuations on all of the returns, then we could probably live with the idea that we'll go along with what the feds have done. But they're understaffed, and they don't really look at all of the items on there. So we've seen some situations where things were, I mean, if you're within 10%, that's probably pretty close to fair market value, but some of these are a lot further off than that.
Representative Earhart.
Mr. Chairman, does that mean if you find, I don't know what your cut score is, but if you find something that's really out of line with the feds, that you're going to suggest that they come to the decedent's estate and say, you better revalue this, or how does that work both ways?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Earhart, that would somewhat be correct, although the situation we have now is that federally the exemption is at $2.5 million for federal purposes. It's only at $1 million for us, and the bulk of the ones that we'd be looking at the valuations would be in this gap, where federally, even if they increased the values a lot, they wouldn't get to the $2.5 million. So we'd like this authority more or less for these ones that are in this gap, where federally there's no tax no matter what we do, but for Minnesota there is tax no matter, you know.
Representative.
Mr. Chairman, that is an area then that we should ever conform with, and then we wouldn't have that gap. I have a billing for that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Earhart, it would be very nice, but it does cost a lot of money.
Yes.
Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to comment that the lead examiner for Minnesota for federal state tax was a friend of mine. They didn't even get a chance to look at a lot of things because they were so understaffed. I think Mr. Haugen already pointed that out.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Haugen, is there Section 19? Is there a fiscal enhancement to that particular provision, or is that practice is what you do now?
Mr. Hogan, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's the same. It's the same argument that we, the assumption when they're doing the numbers is that
everyone's honest.
Everyone's honest. I think the only one where there's any real, and it's not even a significant impact, is we do lose some revenue when we change the credit for the combat zone, because we'll be giving the $60 or $59 a month to a number of people who, under the old law, really wouldn't have qualified.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Greg Heck, and I'm with the department. I'll be going through Article 2, the sales and use tax article. A number of the provisions here are made to conform with the streamlined sales tax agreement, and where Minnesota has the option, we made the election to be as closely compliant with current law as possible. Section 1 establishes and clarifies what the statute of limitations is for claiming bad debt deductions for sales tax. It also provides that if you claim a payment on a previously claimed bad debt, you have to allocate it back between the taxable and non-taxable transactions. Sections 2 and 37 would provide that interest on voter city refund claims would be computed from 90 days after the claim is filed with the commissioner. This would make it consistent with capital equipment and other purchaser refund claims. I think we only received one claim in the last 3 years from border city zones. It's largely been replaced by the Job Z zones.
Mr. Heck, excuse me, Representative.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Heck, I guess when I saw border cities, I perked up a little bit there. But you're saying there's just one claim. I was asking, wondering what the extent of it was. Maybe you answered that already. So,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Marquardt, we've only had one claim that actually was from a border city zone you'd be interested in, but it was only one claim in the last 2 years, and I think it's been almost 2 years since we processed that claim.
And Mr. Heck, is that on then sales tax on equipment and construction? What's that on exactly?
Mr. Heck. Mr. Chairman, it would have been sales tax. I don't know exactly what it was. Probably equipment.
Oh, okay.
Section 3 clarifies that the penalty for not for failure to properly report local sales tax applies to all local sales taxes reported. In addition to the general sales tax, would apply to liquor, lodging, and restaurant taxes that the department administers. Section 4 has been removed by amendment. Section 5 relates to the sales tax and telecommunications services. The department did pick up the streamlined definition for telecommunications services. As a result of that, we had to make some changes to our statute to keep the base as consistent as possible as under current law. The major change is we now tax ancillary services, which we currently tax as telecommunications services beginning January 1st, 2008, so we'll be separately taxing those ancillary services, and later in the bill I'll be referring you to the definitions of those ancillary services. There is some language on page 23 in the bill relating to aggregate delivery services. That has been removed by amendment. We're also making clarification on pest control services. Right now, the statute provides that exterminating services are subject to tax. We just want to clarify that also includes pest control services. We noticed that some states make a distinction between the two. It did come up in one audit the department did, and we think the understanding was that exterminating would also include pest control. This is basically live catch a pest and release them. Exterminating implies to actually kill them or make permanent extermination. Section 6 has been deleted by amendment. Section 7 relates to delivery charges, and you must allocate the delivery charges between the sales price of taxable and non-taxable goods. Section 8 removes the definition of prepaid calling cards from the definition of tangible personal property. They're now treated as a taxable service under the streamlined provision. Section 9 basically would conform then with, this also relates back to telecommunications services to conform our definition. Section 10 has been removed by amendment. Sections 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17 are also telecommunications definitions. In these sections we define ancillary services, conference bridging services, detailed telecommunications billing service, directory assistance, vertical service, voicemail service, and ringtones. These are all items that we currently tax under our current definition of telecommunications, and now we'll tax under specific authority without relying on the general definition. Sections 18 and 26 relate to our gross earnings tax, gross receipts tax on fur clothing. That has been removed by amendment. Section 19 has been removed from the bill by amendment. Section 20 relates to exemption certificates. Under current law, a retailer is relieved from responsibility if they accept a fully completed exemption certificate. If they don't have it and the department requests it, they have 60 days to supply it. This would now ease those requirements. The retailer would now have 90 days to obtain that certificate. And if they receive written requests from the department, they would have 120 days to obtain the certificate to relieve them of any liability for that transaction. Sections 21, 22, 23, 24 also relate to telecommunications. They relate to prepaid wireless calls and prepaid calling services. These are things we currently tax, and we're just changing the definitions now to clarify with streamline. Section 25 provides that we're going to source ancillary services, the ones I previously mentioned, to the customer's primary place of use. This would not be much changed from the way we currently administer the law. Section 27 relates to breast pumps. Currently, the department interpreted breast pumps to be a durable medical equipment. A decision was now made at the national streamlined level that these are not durable medical equipment. We're now moving those into the baby product area in order to keep the current tax treatment, and they will remain exempt. Section 28 relates to advertising materials that are currently sent outside the state. There's an exemption for advertising materials that are mailed or shipped outside of Minnesota. That exemption now applies also to envelopes and reply envelopes. Based upon the recommendation of the Attorney General, we had a case relating to this. We're also now extending to other items that might contain those advertising materials, including boxes, tubes, labels, or cartons. We're also clarifying that items that have a primary purpose to satisfy some other legal purpose, such as rebate checks, insurance policies, billing statements, are not advertising materials if they have another primary purpose. Section 29 relates to packing materials. These are basically materials used to ship household goods outside the state. There's currently an exemption for those items, and this will clarify that it only applies to packing. This is basically box or materials that are given to the customer that remain with the customer and would not apply to any shipping equipment or supplies actually owned by the shipping company itself, by the common carrier, such as a van line company. Section 30, under our new definition of telecommunications, the old definition included satellite broadcasting and cable television services, so therefore they got the benefit of the current exemption for telecommunications equipment. Since they're no longer treated as telecommunications equipment, we're making this change in order that those industries will still get the benefit of capital equipment. So this would preserve their capital equipment exemption for satellite broadcasting and cable television providers. Section 31 relates to hospitals and surgical care centers. We've had a number of situations where hospitals or outpatient surgical centers have merged with other nonprofit entities, largely nursing homes. And what we're providing here is those hospitals or nursing homes, that new entity, the combined merged entity, would also qualify as a hospital if the nonprofit unit that merges with it would have qualified as a nonprofit unit itself prior to the merger after purchasing items that would have qualified under the old nonprofit exemption. Section 32 is also a telecommunications provision. It maintains the exemption for private communication services purchased by the state as a purchasing agent on behalf of the state lottery. This is current law, and we're just moving into a new section. Section 33 sets forth the requirements to have a fully completed exemption certificate. It also provides that the retailer must have the purchaser update that certificate if there's been a change in the purchaser's conditions or other changes that would require that certificate to be updated. Section 34 has been removed by amendment. Section 35 relates to motor carriers who have a direct pay permit, and it provides that the sales price may only be reduced by taxes that are imposed directly on the motor carrier. Under the old law, it allows them to deduct taxes that are imposed upon either the carrier or the retailer. Section 36 relates to the motor vehicle sales tax under Chapter 297B, and it provides that any vehicle purchased for resale in the regular courses of business by a motor vehicle dealer is exempt from the sales tax. Currently reading the statute, it seems to apply that it only applies to vehicles that their dealer place, but we know this is not the case. So this would include vehicles with dealer place, but also vehicles that are just held for resale in the regular course of business. Section 38 has been removed from the bill. In the repealer, paragraph A is removed by amendment. Paragraph B in the repealer, we're repealing the definition of prepaid telephone calling cards. We no longer need that because they're no longer treated as tangible personal property. They're just lumped under taxable services. Paragraph C relates to the multiple points of use sourcing. And relates to software, we no longer need that because it can be sourced under general sourcing laws. And the last paragraph, the last repeal relates to repealing the exemption for items brought into state by non-residents. A reading of that statute now apparently gives a non-resident the right to temporarily store items in the state and remove them without the imposition of the use tax. We know that was not the intent of this statute, and this exemption is no longer needed since we can only impose use tax on goods that are brought into and with the intent to use, store, or consume those items in Minnesota. Mr. Chairman, that's Article 2 of the bill.
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Heck, would you also give me the same type of report that I asked for from the income tax and use tax of the amount of penalties that are assessed as well?
Mr. Chairman, Solberg, yes, I think the department would be more willing to do that.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Heck? Okay. At this time, Representative Lencheski's Article 3.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Pat Finnegan. I'll take you through Article 3, the special taxes article. Article 3 consists of a number of technical changes to various special taxes. The summary has outlined them by tax type, and so that's how I'll just go through it that way. Section 1 of Article 3, this would be on page 46 of the bill, deals with the Joint Underwriting Association, and it simply adds a statutory reference which authorizes the offset to the premiums tax. Section 2 deals with the reciprocal or inter-insurance contract, and it deletes some archaic language. Section 10 and 11 both deal with the fire insurance surcharge, which was enacted last year. Section 10 clarifies that none of the surcharges are subject to retaliation. And Section 11 clarifies that the mutual property and casualty companies that are authorized to make the election must remit the total surcharge collected. And it clarifies the timeline for when that election has to be made. Section 12 deals with the Joint Underwriting Association offset and basically just details when the offset can be claimed. And it's similar to when the Guarantee Association assessment offset is claimed. Section 13 deals with insurance premiums tax underpayment penalty. It amends the definition of tax, which is used to calculate the underpayment penalty, include the retaliatory tax and certain credits, and correct an erroneous cross-reference. Section 14 has been deleted by the amendment. Sections 3 and 4 deal are D-tax proposals. Section 3 is deals with a mortgage foreclosure situation and basically ensures that the exemption only applies if the person who used to own the property is redeeming it. It's not available for any type of creditor. Section 4 deals with deeds to governmental subdivisions for public use and basically says that the deed tax on conveyances from the state to these governmental subdivisions, that the deed tax is going to be $1.65. That's the minimum deed tax. The next three proposals are Minnesota care tax proposals. Section 5 clarifies that an individual person that receives drugs from a non-resident pharmacy is not subject to the use tax. This was effective for purchases made after July 2005. The use tax was no longer imposed on purchases by individuals for personal consumption, so that's why we're making this change. And then Section 6 is clarifying that a non-resident pharmacy is not required to collect the use tax since individuals who purchase drugs for their own use are no longer required to pay the use tax. The non-resident pharmacies are not required to collect the tax. Section 7 clarifies that the refund claimed by pharmacies for amounts paid for drugs delivered outside of Minnesota will be applied against the health care provider tax. Under current law, the refund is applied against the pharmacy tax. This has been repealed. Section 8 and 9 are cigarette and tobacco products tax provisions. Section 8 deals with the tobacco products use tax, and it limits the exemption from the tobacco products use tax to $50, provided that the products were carried into the state by the consumer, and that would be in line with a similar exemption available for cigarettes. Section 9 deals with the cigarette consumer use tax, and it adds a new subdivision to require cigarette consumer use tax on consumer use of cigarettes if the cigarette sales tax has not been paid.
Any questions for Mr. Finnegan, Representative?
Mr. Chairman, I want to go back to that Minnesota care, the use tax. The last sentence that I'm trying to figure out what that means. Under paragraph A, it says a person who receives prescription drugs for resale or use And what I'm wondering about is before you, I think I understand what you're saying for resale.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it would be when someone, an individual, imports drugs for their own personal use in Minnesota from outside the state.
Canadian Pharma.
Representative Carlson?
Then they're subject to the tax.
We're saying now they're no longer subject to the tax.
No longer.
Yeah.
For own use.
Okay. Right.
Okay. Article 4.
We can use your chair. Can we use that chair? Yeah.
Mr. Chair, my name is Lance Darica. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I'll be explaining part of Article 4.
And my name is Harriet Sims, also with the Department of Revenue, and I will be explaining the other parts of Article 4.
Thank you. Sections 1 and 47 of Article 4 have to do with the Metro County wheelage tax. When the statute allowing the wheelage tax was enacted, it provided for levy offsets. They were in specific amounts for specific years. When we came to 2006, when some of the counties decided to implement that, those particular amounts needed to be translated into year neutral amounts, I guess. And so the department worked with the counties to come up with a generic process for doing this estimation of amounts to be collected and offsetting the levies, and Section 1 puts that into effect. Section 47 is something that we didn't do this year, but we thought might be appropriate in this or other similar situations. It would allow the Commissioner of Revenue to prescribe alternate language for the truth in taxation advertisements when changes such as this might change levy amounts. Sections 2 through 9, 22, and paragraph A of section 62 have to do with air flight property tax recodification. 2 years ago, the air flight property tax came up on our list of things to look at. As Mr. Haugen mentioned earlier, get rid of archaic language, put the provisions in a logical sequence, and make policy changes if we have to. Section 2 clarifies that the airplane includes the computers and software that make it fly. Section 3 clarifies that the taxable airplanes or other property of the company are theirs, even if they lease them or otherwise use them. Section 4 amends the statute that says each airline company has to provide an annual report to the commissioner on a date determined by the commissioner. That date has been July 1st for many years. This statute puts July 1 into the law. Section 5 clarifies the lien for the air flight property taxes. When we doing electronic funds payments and so forth, it came to our attention that this tax really goes to the Aeronautics Division of Transportation. We compute the tax and send the notices, but it goes to them. Section 6.
Wasn't you.
I didn't hear it.
That's right.
Section 6 deals with the penalties for the air flight property tax. Currently, there is a penalty for not filing the annual return on time. We are adding penalties that apply to other taxes, but which are not clearly a part of this tax now. The new penalties will be a penalty for repeated instances of filing the report late, a penalty for filing a frivolous report, and a penalty for a fraudulent annual report. Section 62A repeals the current statute in this tax on investigations and examination of books and so forth, and replaces it with a new section of law in Section 7. This statute had its own examination and investigation powers for the Commissioner of Revenue. Those examination and investigation powers were kind of idiosyncratic, a little different than the powers we have in other situations. One of the differences is if the subpoena books from a taxpayer and the taxpayer says, I don't have them, my accountant has them, and he won't give them to me, you have to subpoena our authority to act in that situation with the air flight property tax, for example, was weak. By getting rid of those specific powers and replacing them with these general powers, it more or less just gives us a complete picture. Section 8 is a bit of policy. A reduced class rate, a reduced tax rate is applied to quiet aircraft, which for those who know are familiar with that, that's stage 3 and above. The industry is now producing any new aircraft now have to be stage 4. There isn't a place for them in the current tax scheme. Lacking other suggestions, we're putting them stage 4 in as a quiet aircraft. Section 9 clarifies that when we do send a notice of their value and tax to the taxpayer, that this is an order of the commissioner that they can appeal to tax court. Section 22 adds the air flight property tax to those taxes which the commissioner can abate penalties based on reasonable cause.
Sections 10 through 20 and 25 and 26 and also paragraph B of the repealer all deal with the Board of Assessors, and the purpose for all of these changes is to make editorial and technical changes and streamline some of the language and get rid of parts of the statutes that's obsolete. So in section 10, we're striking the words establish and conduct regarding the board's powers, because the board doesn't establish or conduct any of the training courses. The board approves the training courses and all, but so that's why that is struck. Sections 11 and 16 is merely editorial, so that we can define what the board is, and then throughout the statute we can just refer to the board. Section 12, composition of the board, we're deleting an obsolete reference to the Minnesota Association of Assessors, which is an organization that no longer exists, and it also clarifies that when a member of the board is appointed because they're engaged in a particular capacity, and they're no longer engaged in that capacity, then they are automatically disqualified for membership. It links a reference to the secretary and adds a reference to the vice chair, which would be the correct reference. Section 13, basis for license revocation, that provides that the board may refuse to grant or renew a license or may suspend or revoke a license for failure to comply with the code of conduct and ethics for licensed Minnesota assessors adopted by the board. Last session, legislation required the board to adopt this code of conduct and ethics, which it did. So now the language will just refer to that code of conduct rather than listing out all the conduct which has actually been rolled into that code of conduct. Section 14, prohibited activity. This is really just an editorial change because an assessor, deputy assessor, assistant assessor, or an appraiser are all licensed assessors, so we're just saying a licensed assessor. Section 15, dealing with the charges that they make for courses, examinations, and materials, we're striking out the reference to two of the items because those are things that the board does not do. The board has not charged that amount for course challenge examination because they don't do that and they don't handle retests. So those are two fees that they don't collect now and they won't in the future. Section 18, dealing with rules, we actually had two sections that dealt with rules, and what this does and the part in the repealer does is that moves all of that just into one
one section, so that we're dealing with rules in the one section, and also strikes the last two sentences of section 270.47 dealing with giving examinations, because the board does not actually give the examinations. Section 19 deals with the licensure of qualified persons, and we're changing the shall to the may, and the may is correct because all of the board's duties are discretionary. They may license people. And also in that section, there's some other technical kind of grammatical changes. Section 20, dealing with the employment of licensed assessors, makes a minor grammatical change, and it also strikes some sentences that require counties and local districts to pay the cost of training courses and allow cities 90 days from the date of incorporation to employ a licensed assessor. These provisions don't relate to the board at all, because the board is just a licensing body.
Now that's Sims, excuse me, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So currently, the board already may revoke these licenses. This is just a different process under which they will, or the standards is now in the code of conduct instead. And then the second is they currently now may choose not to issue the license, and that, they have.
That is correct. And that these are really comports with the board's current powers, and there are also promulgated rules under which the board operates, so that they would have a, there are reasons why they wouldn't issue a license, for instance, if the person doesn't meet the requirements set up in the board's rules, or if they may not meet the ethics requirements. For any number of those reasons, the board would refuse to grant a license.
Representative Broughton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm just wondering, back on Section 19, it says that the assessors must be licensed within 3 years of employment. That seems like quite a long period of time. I'm wondering how many assessors are operating in an unlicensed fashion.
Ms. Sims.
Representative, I don't know that... don't know the answer to that. We did not want to make any changes, but merely update the language and the current language that there is. I believe maybe someone from the property tax division would know how many, if we have a number of assessors that are currently not licensed.
Representative Broad.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just get that information separate from this hearing. I don't need it today. I'm just kind of curious about it.
Okay.
I will get back to you.
Okay.
Section 20, regarding appointment of licensed assessors, that language that's being stricken is not being lost. It's just being moved to Chapter 273, which deals with cities and towns and employment of licensed assessors. And also there's a sentence that states that if the governing body of a township fails to employ an assessor, the assessment may be made by the county assessor. That's being stricken because that provision is already in Section 273.05, and it doesn't need to be in two places. And the repealers are, which are in section 62, paragraph B. We are repealing 270.41 subdivision 4. And some of that language then is being moved to 270.47. That was that situation that I talked about earlier, where we had the provisions dealing with rulemaking in two separate places, and now they will all be in one section.
Section 27043 is also being repealed because it conflicts with Section 27042. One of them says that members of the board receive no compensation. The one that was enacted later in time says, or was amended later in time, says that the compensation of members shall be as provided in Sections 214.07 to 214.09, which states that the board members may be paid a per diem if it's approved by the board. And I understand the board's practice has been to follow 214.09, which says that they may pay a per diem, and so this does not represent additional money that they would be paying. There are also two provisions that are being repealed, 270.51 and 270.53, because they're obsolete transitional provisions, and 270.52 deals with the cost of making assessments, because that is also dealt with in Chapter 273. And all of these provisions are effective the day following final enactment.
Mr. Chair, it gets a little complicated if you're following in the bill, but Sections 21 and 24 are an instance, I can't resist the opportunity to point out that this is an instance where the Department of Revenue will be collecting fewer Social Security numbers. Sections 21 and 24 have to do with certificates of real estate. Everyone who sells property for over $1,000 in price has to file one of these forms. It requires everybody on the deed to sign and give their Social Security number. We've gotten people who have called us and said that in certain situations, a spouse has to sign the deed conveying the property out, even though that spouse has no ownership, co-ate or inchoate, marital, present, future. That person may have no interest in the property whatsoever, but because of another law in Minnesota that says both spouses have to sign the conveyance of homestead property, and you can't always tell what's the homestead and what isn't. We've got a practice in Minnesota where if you're a married couple, both people have to sign the deeds, at least with residential property, I think a lot more. So this would say if the only reason you're signing the deed is because the statute requires both spouses to sign, meaning that you have no ownership interest, present or future, present or future claim, that you don't have to give us your Social Security number. Section 23 amends the job zone property tax exemption, say that the business has to notify the county assessor in order to begin receiving the exemption. This will not apply until taxes payable in 2008. The provision itself in the bill will be effective the day following final enactment, but this will not change exemptions. This will not change exemptions in this year.
Mr. Arcaria, I think at this time we're going to probably hold up because we're not going to get through this whole bill. So, Representative Walschlager, would you give us a chance to have some minutes from the Monday the 29th meeting?
Thank you, Chair. I move we approve the minutes.
Okay. We have a motion. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Members, remember to save your summary and your bill in your packet, and we will continue on Wednesday. Representative Lencheski, correct?
Correct.
All right, we are adjourned.